Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Oh my goodness, we're going to be talking about a subject matter that all of us, in one way or another, can relate to. And what is that? It's plants. Now, we're going to be talking about how to communicate with plants with Jen Frey. And she is in Pennsylvania, I believe. And of course, that's gorgeous, gorgeous country. But Jen is a healer. She also has worked for over 20 years with students, teaching them how to work with plants, how to communicate with plants. And there is so much behind this, not from her perspective, because it's a very personal association that she has, but science has been researching plants for a number of decades. And they find that plants respond to pain. They respond to emotional environments they're in. There is so much that goes on with plants. And we're going to be discussing it maybe in a little bit of a different context than perhaps you would think we would be discussing it. Jen Frey, I welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Jen, having an association with plants, I don't know of anyone that doesn't have them in their environment one way or the other, whether they grow them in their own house or they just go out to the park to appreciate things. Nature surrounds us, and we are finding more and more, and it's being promoted more and more, that we have to honor and respect this environment much more than what we have done, because in this environment is our wellness. In this environment is the aspect of understanding ourselves mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. You, however, have taken it further than I would say many of us would. You have gotten into energy work with plants and plant essences. All of this has filled your life so fully, and you continue to learn from it. When did you really begin to recognize how much being in nature really was significant to you and to the wellness in your own life?
I think as far as the recognizing aspect, I would say it was in my early 20s. But honestly, they were a part of my life from just about birth. I mean, I share a little bit in my book that my grandparents were very pivotal in my upbringing, but also my relationship to plants. So I always say that I feel like I didn't have a choice, that plants had to be a significant part of my life, because it was for my grandparents, and they just taught me the importance of growing your own food, getting medicine from plants. For my maternal grandfather, he taught me the importance of singing to the plants and having music played for them, and raising plants with love and how that affects yourself and your well-being. But, you know, as kids, we often aren't very conscious of that. We just kind of take it and usually take the wisdom that we receive for granted. And so I'd say it was in my 20s when I had been studying herbs really since elementary school, but went even deeper when my kids were born. And I would spend my mornings, I had my children very young, so I was 21 and 24 when I had my two children, so I was in my mid-20s and would spend my mornings picking berries, and I had lots of problems that I would wake up with, that I would be mulling over, not sure how to deal with, and those early morning hours were my only respite when I didn't have somebody that was needing something from me. And so as I was with the trees, all of the answers started coming to me, and I started finding solutions. I also just started to feel better and feel hopeful and ready to deal with my day. And so it took me a while, but that's when I realized, oh, all of this info is coming from the plants. That's where it's coming from, and I just realized how important it is for me to be in close relationship with them.
Plants bring so much into life. They really, really do. And I'm always fascinated with them. Now, I'm not engaged with the plants to the degree that you are. However, they do convey a lot of information. They give you details. It's really quite fascinating. And I recall reading, oh my goodness, so many years ago about the scientist who actually wrote a book about how in his laboratory he did experiments with plants, and we have Mr. Emoto that did the experiments with water in plants and communication. This has been out and about for such a long time, but it appears that it's becoming more and more important to people now because we realize that we have had an effect on the planet by destroying so much of the natural environment without understanding how we can live in the environment and be a partner with it and not be its enemy and not destroy ourselves in the process. This is something that has taken a long time for people to catch up with, hasn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, mainstream, yes. But everything that you were talking about with the scientists, Cleve Baxter is the one with the laboratory, and you know, his work really became well known in 1973 when The Secret Life of Plants was published. And I can pull that out so easily because I inherited that book from my grandfather. My grandfather bought it the year it was first came out. And unfortunately, I didn't read that book until after my grandfather had dementia. So I didn't actually read it until after he was too far gone in his dementia, because I have my suspicions that my grandfather was consciously communicating with plants.
Mm-hmm.
So I say yes and no, because all of these great scientific studies that are coming out, they all just prove what the indigenous have known all along and what all of our ancestors have known, that plants are intelligent, that we can communicate with them, that they have so much information and so much guidance to offer us. And when we're in relationship with them, we can find a better, an easier way to thrive, to be in health. And so while that's all been known, you know, there's also been this part of our cultural paradigm is the separation of nature and the dominion of humans over nature. And so, and science plays a role in that as well. And so, yes, our mainstream culture is just starting to catch on to it. And as you said, it is growing, and that's exciting to me because while this used to be kind of a cult thing of, you know, some real big plant lovers, of course, all the indigenous people around the world doing this, but also in our mainstream, like some real big plant lovers were talking about this in smaller groups. I think it's really necessary for the health of our society and the well-being of our future, our ability to continue to live in a to continue to live on Earth, but also hopefully in a more thriving way, that we communicate with plants. And it needs to be more than just plant lovers that are doing this work, because the plants can offer us the solutions that we need no matter what the area of the situation is. So we need builders, we need engineers. I mean, that's the basis of biomimicry field right now, right, is looking at nature to help them figure out better ways of engineering products or buildings or whatever it is that they're working on. But we can also get those direct information from the plants. And so whatever field we're in, they have something to offer us. And it's just important that all of us are able to do this work. And we all are innately able to. It's just really having to overcome our conditioning that we've been trained in that,
mm-hmm.
that we're not able to communicate with nature.
Ki, or perhaps you pronounce it differently, K-I.
I say ki, yeah.
Ki. You use that word when you are writing in your book.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you choose that word? Where did it come from and what does it mean?
Yeah, so ki, it's spelled K-I. And I learned this phrase or this word from Robin Wall Kimmerer. I believe she talks a little bit about it in her incredible book, Braiding Sweetgrass. But also, there's an article she wrote, Nature Needs a New Pronoun, for Yes Magazine. And that's where she really puts this forward. So ki is a genderless third-person pronoun. So we have a tendency to refer to plants as it. And for me, I've been using this word primarily in writing. I also do use it in communication, but sometimes I find verbal communication, I mean, but sometimes I find when I'm speaking, particularly to people who aren't aware of this pronoun, that I'll revert back to either it, he, or she, or they. I prefer they, actually. But when we use the word it, what we're doing is we're putting plants in a position of commodity rather than a position of relationship, a kinship, recognizing them as a sovereign being who's intelligent. And so when we use it, it becomes much easier to use them without abandon, you know, just take whatever we want, cut them down without thinking about it, without giving them any really thought or respect. And so Robin had really pondered this idea because in indigenous languages, they use animistic language. So they recognize, they don't talk about plants as objects to be used. They talk about plants as living beings. And so she put this word forward. The plural for it is kin, K-I-N. And what I started to say is that I've been using this for well over 5 years, I'm not sure, maybe 6 or 7 years when I first read the article. And I noticed that my brain has shifted now. And so now when I read, particularly from an herbal person or a plant lover or somebody really connected with nature, when I read something that they wrote that uses the word it, it just hits me so hard in the chest. And so I just noticed that using that word has really shifted my brain, shifted my thinking. I've always looked at plants as these, you know, teachers, these loved ones, but it's deepened with it. And so I think it's really powerful if we can shift that that mindset.
You chose 16 plants to highlight in your book, and a number of them I'm familiar with, but some of them I'm not. Now, there's the mulberry plant. There's the yarrow plant, mugwort, which anybody that's a lover of Harry Potter is going to just say, oh, yes, I remember mugwort. And plantain, dandelion, maple, poison ivy, Japanese hops, black-eyed Susan, willow, rose, poison hemlock, eastern hemlock, and corn, rosemary, tulsi. And there's just so much in this book, and the illustrations that you told me before we started our conversation that this was done by a young woman that was a student of yours, and they are absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, so first I just want to push back a little bit on that I chose, because I really didn't choose these plants. The plants chose them. And when I first started writing this book, I didn't know it was going to be about plant communication, and I originally had a list of 33 plants. But then I quickly realized that there's no way I could talk about 33 plants. And, like, either the book's going to be over 1,000 pages or I'm just going to be giving them a brief synopsis and it wouldn't be doing them justice. So I sat down again and asked who wants to be in the book. And these 16 plants are the ones that they volunteered. Some I really pushed back on, like Black-Eyed Susan in particular. I really didn't want to write about. But they were insistent that these are the plants. And, you know, the plants generally, I want to say always, but I try not to be absolute in my language, are right. And it was just a magical experience to write with them. And then Lillian's illustrations, they just bring out the work. She's so talented, and she really works with the plant spirits themselves. And so when I saw her illustrations, she would send them to me in batches, and sometimes I would just cry at them because she captured the spirit of the plant so well, as well as, like, put forward my experience of them. And so it just adds so much to the book, and I'm so grateful to her.
Oh, no kidding. I mean, this is just absolutely beautifully done. Now, there is a statement by Khalil Gibran that you made in the book, trees are poems that the earth writes upon the sky. And we know how important trees are. We have seen the loss of so much around the planet. Now, people are changing. their environments in many parts of the world. They are introducing plants, trees. China has done something like a million trees or more that they put in, and that has worked to a point, and in another way it hasn't worked because they had everything the same species, which was not a good thing to do. But that's all right. You know, that's part of learning. But it's not just China. There's areas in deserts that are coming to life. I think of a woman that I don't remember where the desert was. It might have been in an area of China. But all by herself, she started planting trees, and it changed the environment dramatically. And it was just one tree at a time. And people thought she was crazy. And she said, that's tough. But they thrived. And now there has been a big support for her work, especially by the government. I do think it was China. I was thinking of someplace else, but there's areas in the Middle East. They're doing the same thing. You bring out in your book the Eastern Hemlock. We do not have it out here on the West Coast, to the best of my awareness, but we have a lot of different trees, a lot of different trees out here on the West Coast. But the Eastern Hemlock, you say, is in danger because of a parasite that infects it. What is the status of the Eastern Hemlock, and why was the Eastern Hemlock one of those that chose to be in the book?
Well, I think, I don't know that I can fully answer why, but besides to say they said so, but, the Eastern Hemlock is a big teacher tree. They are a pioneer tree, so they were one of the first trees to grow after the glaciers receded in this area. So they're very ancient for this particular area where I live. And in fact, not far from here, there's a gorgeous forest that has old-growth eastern hemlocks, which is just such a sweet experience to be in them. I know, West Coast, like, it's kind of the synonymous to the redwoods, though our trees are much smaller than the redwoods, but it's just such a magical time when you can ever get to be with these ancient, large trees. But eastern hemlock in particular is a big teacher for change. I was first introduced to them by my teacher, Kate Gilday, and she says that Eastern Hemlock helps us to change with grace. And, you know, we're all facing big changes, earth changes, that we can no longer ignore, and it's affecting our daily lives now. No matter where we live, the earth changes are affecting us. And so we really need help in change. As humans, we tend to say we like change, but really when it happens, we tend to get scared and want to retreat and want things to stay the same, whereas change is just an inevitable part of life. And so Eastern Hemlock really helps us to navigate these changes. And one of the other big lessons that I learned from Eastern Hemlock is really about death. I mean, I think that's like the biggest fear that we have is death. And our culture just is so adverse to talking about death in such a healthy way. And so Eastern Hemlock just really clearly taught me that death is just a transformation and it's just a change of form, and that what we consider as death, so, you know, as you said, many of these Eastern Hemlock trees are dying. And one of the stories I share in there is I was walking in this old-growth forest, and I saw this trunk of an eastern hemlock, and it was huge, and it was gorgeous, and I was just so drawn to it. But then when I looked up, I realized that the tree was dead. And I said, oh, you're dead. And the tree just responded, like, no, I'm not. Look at me. And just showed me all the beings who were living because of this tree, like the ants, the fungi, the birds that were nesting in there, the squirrels that were nesting in there. All the, you know, parasites, like there's just so much life that tree was feeding, and just really teaching me about, again, change with grace.
Mm-hmm. Mugwort. I couldn't pass this one up. this is something, just the name, mugwort. You wonder, who came up with that, for heaven's sakes? That is so unique, so unusual. And you said you became familiar with the spirit of the mugwort when you were in a plant spirit healing apprenticeship with Pam Montgomery. And this is named after a goddess. Mugwort? That doesn't sound very, you know, goddess-like. What goddess is it named after?
Artemisia, or Artemis. And mugwort, I'm told the name mugwort comes, wort means healing plant, and mug was because it was used to make beer.
Oh, okay, now that's logical. All right, but with what is the mug? The mugwort is a very unique plant, as all plants are, but this is something that was surprising to me, the mugwort. Let's share what its benefits are.
Well, my gosh, there's so many benefits of mugwort. But when I think of, I'm not sure, you might have your own that you're like highlighting here. But when I think of mugwort, I go to integrity. And so what mugwort does is just, one, helps us to remember our wild self, that part of us that never left nature. We all contain it, no matter how citified we are, no matter how scared we are to be out in nature. There is still an aspect of us that remembers what it is like to be in alignment with nature, because we are nature. You know, our entire bodies are actually a universe of many different beings. And so, one, mugwort helps us to remember that. But as part of that, also just helps us to move into our integrity. And that's different than how we normally think about it. So when I talk about mugwort, I use capital I for integrity. And so in our culture, we talk a lot about what I call lowercase I integrity, staying in a job, staying married for life, you know, always following through with your word, giving more of yourself, just always thinking of others. And they can be the same as capital I integrity. But for me, the capital integrity is about doing what is really in alignment with your soul, what really your soul wants. So sometimes that means we need to leave a relationship or we need to leave a job. We might need to look like a fool to other people because we have to follow our soul path and our soul's longing. And that can be really scary, particularly in the beginning. But mugwort helps us and guides us along in that way. And the more we do it, the easier we find it is to just really honor our soul path and do what's needed for us. And we, in my experience and in those I've witnessed, we end up living much more fulfilling lives. Whereas when we stick with those, when we stay in situations that aren't in alignment with our soul path, they're actually depleting. And to the point that, you know, it can cause early death. It can cause depression. It can cause all kinds of issues. And I think we see it a lot in our culture because we're not really leading these lives that our souls are longing for.
The Black-Eyed Susan. Now, I don't know that I've seen that very often here in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. But you, I smiled when I was reading this portion of the book because you really weren't too interested in writing about the Black-Eyed Susan, yet you were impressed that this was something you needed to include in the book. Why is the Black-Eyed Susan so significant?
Well, so first of all, I'm laughing because that's still finding the answer to that. It's actually come up recently with, I'm on a board for the Organization of Nature Evolutionaries, and we were talking about this with my director, and I'm still finding the answer, like, why did Black-Eyed Susan want to be in this book? But Black-Eyed Susan really helps us to shift our story and to look at it with another perspective. So we all have experiences in our lives that we can call trauma, that, you know, somebody did something to us or it was just traumatic, it was harmful, and we can hold on to those stories, and we look at them, and we can identify ourselves with them. They can determine the way our life goes. But Black-Eyed Susan encourages us, as we heal, to look at those stories again, and it's really powerful when we are able to look at those stories with a different perspective and see perhaps there was a gift in there, or perhaps we can see the woundedness of whoever it was that we consider harmed us, and we can look at it with compassion, and we can also look at the stories without having them put meaning on us, that we're not defined by those experiences. And so Black Eyed Susan really wanted to talk about that, the importance of changing our stories, and really about healing from trauma, because we've all been traumatized. We all carry generations of trauma in us. And really, in order to get this better, more healthy world, we have to heal that trauma. We have to stop those cycles of generational trauma. And so Black Eyed Susan is there to help us guide.
The last one that I want to mention, of course, there's many more in your book. I would like to mention The Rose. Mm-hmm. Now, this, I remember there was an event I was a part of in the booth that was adjacent to me, because I was a vendor. The booth that was adjacent to me had all of these essences, and I remember trying to smell a number of them, and I couldn't do it. But as soon as I came to the rose, I said, I love it. She said, yes, that seems to be the favorite of just about everybody. And the rose just brings so much richness into life. I was fascinated with the fact that you had done research on the rose, and the rose was here millions and millions and millions of years ago, which is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my teacher, Rocio Alarcón, she talks about rose as being one of the master plants. So master plants are big teacher plants, and often, particularly nowadays, often they are psychotropic, and part of their teaching is about getting in touch with the oneness of humanity and going beyond our human experience. And so she, you know, says that once upon a time rose was the master plant, but just as I continue through my own journeys with my clients, with my students, with my own life, more and more I feel like rose is awakening up humanity, and I really think may be the master plant for us. Maybe not right now, maybe it's still coming, but I just keep finding more people, as you said, like rose is attracting them. And as I think he should, because rose is all about love. I mean, it's like, even if you're not a plant person, you know that rose is a symbol of love, and the symbols are there for a reason. And it is that rose really helps us to learn how to love ourselves, which is at the foundation, I think, of all the work that we need to be doing, is learning how to love ourselves, how to uncover, again, those wounds, those conditionings that have been put on us, to remember the truth of our being, which is that we are all love. And in that, rose also helps us to learn how to be more loving towards other people, and shows us a different form of strength, which I think is what's needed. That so often in our world we think about strength as being domination and violence, and rose really shows us that true strength comes from the heart and comes from acting in love.
The flower essences, the plant essences, you say this is very different from the oils. And I know that perhaps a number of my listeners are very much engaged with one or the other, maybe even both. Mm-hmm. So explain for those of us that may not have an awareness of the differences between the essences and the oils. Would you go into that a little bit?
Sure. So an essential oil, it contains the volatile organic compounds of a plant, which might not mean anything to you, but basically means the scent. So if you take a mint leaf and you crush it and you smell that mint, what you're smelling is the volatile organic compounds being released. And so to gain the essential oil from a plant, it takes, depending on the plant, it takes a significant amount of plant material. So for a very small bottle of rose essential oil, you need like tractor trailer loads of roses. And we can get, there's also a hydrosol, which I don't really talk about in my book, but where we can get the scent of the plant through steam distillation. So we need a smaller amount of the plant there. But basically, with either of them, what we're working with is the smell component. And we know how potent smell is, that brings in memories, can really affect healing, can change the environment. So they are definitely potent healers, but also potent, meaning they're very, very strong in very, very small parts, and often we don't want to ingest them because they can be poisonous. Whereas the flower essences, or I call them spirit essences, they contain the energetic components of a plant. So it's like the energetic component of a plant in liquid form, which is water, that's then stabilized usually with alcohol. Some people use vinegar. And so they're very different. For mine, I don't actually use any plant material. Many flower essence practitioners do, but even if they do, it's a very small amount of plant material that's required for them. And we use a dilution factor similar to homeopathy, where if you when you make an essence, you're making what we call the mother essence, and we dilute that down to a stock essence, which is what you would buy in a store. And then if you go to a flower essence practitioner, they'll dilute that stock essence down even more to a dosage essence, and it's that dosage essence that we take daily, we ingest internally, that we can also put on our body or in sprays and baths, and it just helps us to, it shifts, it works more on the emotional, spiritual realm, but when we talk about flower essences, people often think because it's emotional, spiritual, that they're very subtle, and they can be, but they can also produce great change. Because anything, all of our physical ailments started in that emotional, spiritual realm first. So if we can address it there, then we don't need to have the physical stuff going on. That's what I would say about the difference.
One of the plants that you've not had success with is the rosemary plant. And I laughed when I read that because I thought, okay, this is a woman that has a super green thumb, basically, and she says the rosemary plant just, you say you've killed about 20 of them. And I just laughed because I've got a friend that she says, Donna, I went and took her a very nice plant, and she said, Donna, you know I'm the plant killer of the universe. She said, nothing grows around me. And I just laughed at her because I know that that doesn't have to be the case. But I also know a great deal about her life and why that, you know, she has such a difficulty with plants, but that's okay. It is something, though, rosemary, there is a tradition in the Italian world, at least as I'm aware of, because that's part of my background, is that a rosemary plant, the size of the rosemary plant, if you have a rosemary plant that somebody has grown, that it's usually the woman that rules the household. If the rosemary plant does not grow very much, this is a tradition that I was told about a long time ago, then it means that the woman does not rule the household. But if it's lush and abundant, by golly, she's the boss. And we had a friend that she showed us her rosemary plant, and that rosemary plant was in this monstrous pot, and it was huge, absolutely huge. She had to trim it back frequently. I mean, it was just massive. And I just have to chuckle over that. But you say that's not necessarily the case.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it is. I mean, I was single for a long time, even when I was killing the rosemaries. But, you know, I think actually the plants are probably the rulers of my house, so that might still be true. But, yes, I've definitely have sadly killed many, many rosemaries, and yet rosemary still keeps wanting to show up at my house. And when I go to plant shows or stores, rosemary often will call out and say, please take me home. And I would have these conversations with rosemary saying, you don't want to come home with me. I'm going to kill you. But they kept insisting on coming home. And so we would, and lo and behold, I would end up killing them. Much to my sadness, it would always cause me quite a bit of grief. But one of the things I've been learning in that is one of rosemary's great teachings is about forgiveness and just, the plants are so forgiving in general. I think often when people first learn about plant communication, they get scared because they're worried what these plants are going to say to them, knowing how horrible humans have been to the earth. But really the plants just, they are so gracious, and they just teach us again and again to forgive us, that we're beings of love, and they just try and guide us and help us be who we're meant to be. So, yeah. And I did also realize more recently, I was like, oh, you know, I'm trying to grow rosemary in a place that rosemary doesn't want to grow. Like, this is not where I live. It is not anywhere close to the natural habitat of rosemary, whereas when I spent time in Northern California, their rosemary was, like you said, like these giant bushes. And I was like, oh, this is what rosemary is supposed to be like? It's so different.
And there's different species of rosemary, too. Of course, it's a wonderful seasoning that we use with chicken and vegetables. And it's just an incredible seasoning. And it is also very, very beneficial. And this is something that you bring out in the book, that many of our plants, we use them as teas, we can use them as poultices, and there are so many things that we can benefit from that really are very, very significant, and it takes time to learn that, depending on where you live, what country you're in, whether you're in a desert, you know, a seaside environment, the Pacific Northwest, the East Coast, wherever you might be, there are plants that are meant to thrive in those environments. And sometimes we get surprises. We have plants that decide to visit us and you go, where did you come from? And, you know, you have plants that take up residence. And it's really a fascinating world of plants that we have around us. And their benefits are just phenomenal. And I think if we can remember that ancient peoples up to today have figured out how to use these chemical properties. And all pharmaceuticals come from plants. So this is an aspect of understanding that I think is wonderful. And I think it's great to encourage children to be aware of this. It makes all the difference in the world. Your granddad, your grandmother, they had a tremendous influence on you that carries forth even today. So they left you a beautiful legacy. And your book, Communicating with Plants, Heart-Based Practices for Connecting with Plant Spirits, is not just beautiful with the illustrations, but so informative. Now, Jen, you have a website. It's called Brigid's Way, Brigid's Way.com. And they'll find out about your book and about your classes and so many other things that you bring to help people, well, learn about what you've learned. And I think it's just amazing. Again, it's a book that for anybody that's a plant lover or someone that wants to explore this scientifically, I think it's a lovely publication. And Jen Frey, I wish you nothing but the best. And by the way, Jen's last name is spelled Frey. J-E-N is her first name. Frey is her last. Jen, thank you for being my guest. It's been a delight.
Oh, thank you so much, Don. I so appreciate you, and I always love talking about the plants, so thank you.
I can relate. I totally get it. And when you come up with your next book, be sure you let me know.
Okay.
This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break for just a moment. We will be back. And of course, as always, we have some good things to share. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio, able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Who's coming up on The Donna Sebo Show? Well, tomorrow evening, we're going to be talking about the afterlife, a journey to with Stefan Chong, who's actually in Australia. We're going to have a lovely chat with him. And then life-enhancing anxiety, Kirk Schneider. Ah, yes, we will find out how anxiety can be life-enhancing. Then emotional freedom techniques for animals. EFT for animals. Joan Roquette is a woman that I've had on my show before, and she is so skilled at communicating with animals. I know you'll enjoy this. And then of bears and weight loss, Dr. Brian is going to be my guest. And if you are like so many of us, the battle of the bulge is an ever-challenging one. So we're going to be discussing that. And we just have a great lineup on Warriors for Peace. We're going to be talking about that coming up in the Silicon Heartland. There are so many wonderful people, so many wonderful events that are happening this month. And I want you to know, if you go to my website, not only are you going to be able to see the calendar with all of the various activities that are going on. For example, on the 26th, I am going to be at the Psychic Spectrum in the banquet room at the Poodle Dog, and you can go in and check my calendar, see the location, get all of the information there at the time. I'll be there probably before 5 o'clock and available for mini sessions, as well as bringing a lot of books with me. And then at the end of this month, we are going to be doing the MeWe Expo at the Bellevue Embassy Suites here in Washington. And the information about that is available to you as well. So check out my website, DelphiInternational.com, and you will find out all the details on that weekend, which is the last weekend of July. You know, here in the Pacific Northwest, that last weekend typically has been known for being the perfect weekend for having just about any activity. And when I became aware of that many years ago, I made sure that if I was going to have a summer party, I was going to have it on that weekend. And there are so many activities that go on. And for some reason, that weekend, and I know I did gatherings for well over 20 years, that weekend the weather always was beautiful. It could be absolutely lousy the day before, clean everything up outside, and it was just magnificent. I think the coolest temperature I can recall having on the last weekend of July was in the low 70s. And yeah, that was just perfect. Absolutely perfect. Anyway, I also want to remind you that the Donna Sebo Show, the Donna Sebo Television Show, is now up. We have our programs that have been aired so far are up on my website. And we have basic links that are going to be in the newsletter every month on the 1st, which will be available to you, those of you that receive the newsletter. It will also be online because my newsletters are posted. So you'll find it online, and all you have to do is tap on that link. It'll take you directly to the programs that we have done. And there's also the announcements every month as to when the shows are aired. And right now, they're being aired on Channel 22 in the state of Washington, TCTV, down in Olympia, Washington. And it's at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when we are airing the shows. And the first show was on human trafficking. The second show was on super aging. The third show is on regenerative medicine, stem cell research. And this is something we have got another show that's coming up shortly. And that is going to be about Faces of Leadership, and that is the title. And we will have more than one program relative to that particular title. And we will find that there's a lot of different perspectives regarding leadership that I think will be of interest to those of you that are going to be watching the programs. And so just know they are available also on our YouTube video channel. And again, that's one of the links that will be provided in the newsletter, also on our website, DelphiInternational.com. Well, I wanted to encourage you too to check out the author's showcase so that we have all of that information available to you. We've got upcoming authors that are going to be listed in that showcase area, and it enables you because we list the interviews that they've had with us, including interviews that were done on television for those that have been featured on the TV show. So all of that will be available with those authors that have been featured. So I wanted to remind you of that as well. Well, here we are in the summer months, and I thought, after all of our talk about plant communication, well, it might be a good idea to share with you a little bit of Polish tradition regarding the summers. Europe has so many different cultures within its borders that their history is just amazing, and sometimes different components of the European environment, they have particular foods that they really like to serve. And one of those foods that the Polish people really like, you may think it's Russian, but they're also close together. Remember, when it comes to food, people often exchange their recipes and do their own adaptations. Well, this is a recipe that was given to me by Jane Yolen. She's an author. And she said, this is Julita's sour cherry pierogi. Now, if you don't know what a pierogi is, it's a pastry that's filled, sometimes with meat or vegetables. I mean, it is just like a turnover in American description. And it is a pastry. You fill it. And in this case, it's with sour cherries. And of course, this is the time of the year here in the Pacific Northwest when the stores are loaded with cherries. We have the Bing cherry, we have the Queen Anne cherry, we've got all kinds of cherries, and they are dearly loved. And this is something when your cherries, when you pick your cherries, if they're sour, if they are known for being sour, then before you pit them, you clean them and soak them in 20 minutes in enough cold water to cover them. Now, I had never heard about this, but this does affect the tartness of the cherry. And you add a tablespoon or two of vinegar per quart of water that's used. And then you just let them sit for 20 minutes, no longer than that. Just 20 minutes, set your timer, wash a dish or two or whatever. And at the end of that 20 minutes, then go back and rinse them off thoroughly. And you can make your pierogi also with blackberries, raspberries, blueberries, whatever is your pleasure. I've got a friend she's got a harvest of raspberries this year. I got an email from her, and she's making preserves with them. She's just thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying the process. Now, this is what you're going to need for the sour cherry pierogi. You're going to need 1 1/4 cups of sour cherries, 2 tablespoons of sugar, 2 teaspoons of all-purpose flour. Now, that is your filling. Your dough, you need 1 3/4 cups of all-purpose flour. And you're going to need a little extra because you're going to need to have this down on your pastry board or your counter, wherever it is that you work with dough. You're going to need a little bit of sea salt, 1 egg, which should be beaten at room temperature. And then you're going to need 1/4 cup of milk. Now, you can use any kind of milk you want, cow, almond, coconut, rice, flax milk. It doesn't make any difference. Whatever milk you want to use, almond milk. 1/4 cup of water. Now, that's for the dough. So, again, that's 1 3/4 cups of flour. Have extra on the side, a dash of sea salt, 1 egg beaten, 1/4 cup of milk, 1/4 cup of water. Now, you're also going to need to have a pot ready to go, because in that pot, you need to have 2 quarts of water, a teaspoon of sea salt, and a teaspoon of your favorite oil. And there is something you can serve along with it if you so desire, and that's 1/4 cup of yogurt or sour cream and 2 teaspoons of sugar added to that. Now, let's start with the recipe from the beginning. The filling, of course, you want the pitted cherries, and you can buy those already canned and cut them in half. And you want to take those cherries that have been cut in half and put them aside. If you have the fresh cherries, the difference between the fresh cherries and what I would say the canned cherries is tremendous. But if you get the frozen cherries, make sure that you put them into a strainer of some kind so that the liquor from the cherries will go down. So into a container, and you might be able to use that too. Now, with your filling, the sugar, flour, put that aside. And then to make your dough, your 1 3/4 cups of flour and the salt. You mix that in a large bowl very, very well. Then make a well in the center of your flour. Add the egg to the well. Mix everything together. Slowly add your milk. Keep mixing. Slowly add the water. Keep mixing. You're going to mix until you have a real smooth dough. If you have something like a bread hook on your mixer, you can let the machine do the work. Then what you want to do, once the dough has come all together, you are going to want to take some flour, scatter it over a table or a large wooden board, put your dough on the floured surface, and use a rolling pin. Or if you don't have a rolling pin, you can use something like a glass bottle or even, you know, a plastic kind of a bottle or container. And you're going to roll your dough out to 1/2 inch thickness. And make sure that you have got some flour on that working surface that you're going to use. And then you are going to start the process of putting the pierogi together. Now, your pierogi, you're going to put it, once it's all put together, you're going to put it, the water in the pot and let it come to a boil. You're going to take an upside-down glass or a round cookie cutter. You want to have it so that it's 3.5 inches wide. You want those wide circles because you are going to find that you're only going to be putting a tablespoon of the mixture inside of the pierogi. So these are not big pierogies. And then you're going to take a little bit of your sugar and flour mixture, put that over the cherries, and then you're going to moisten the edges of each circle with water and fold the circle over to make a half moon shape. And of course, you're going to pinch the edges to seal them. When you have 8 pierogies that you've already prepared, your water is boiling on the stove, and you put the pierogi in very gently, one at a time, until the dough is really tender. And that's 7 to 10 minutes. And you're going to remove them from the boiling water with a slotted spoon, and I would say put a paper plate, or you could have paper towels on a platter, and as they come out of the boiling water, then you're going to want to sprinkle them with some sugar, confectionery sugar, or the crystal sugar is always good to use because it gives it that little bit of extra crunchy taste. Or you can take the yogurt, mix the sugar in the yogurt, and use the yogurt as a dipping sauce, or even just pour it right over the pierogi. Now, what's nice when you're fixing this is that you can freeze them. Once you have made your pierogi, the uncooked pierogi, you want to put it on parchment sheets that are on baking sheets, and then you want to put them in the freezer and freeze them. It's going to take about 2 hours for them to really be solidly frozen. And then transfer the frozen pierogi to, you know, one of your Ziploc bags. Store them in the freezer. They keep very, very nicely for 2 to 3 months. If you have one of those special sealing units, they'll last even longer. They won't get the freezer burn. And just when you're ready to serve them, all you do is take them out of the freezer, have your water boiling, cook them a little bit longer, 8 to 12 minutes until they're tender, and then you can serve them. But this basic dough recipe, if you wanted to make a pierogi mixture with sausage or vegetables or, you know, whatever was your pleasure, or fruit, then this is something you can keep in mind. They are just absolutely like turnovers. That's what I would call them as an American. I mean, we used to get those kinds of pies when I was in school, and we all loved them. Of course, they were commercially made, but they were given a coating of, what do I want to say, of the confectionery sugar that you mix with milk, you know, and then you just dribble it over it, and it forms that extra coating of sugar. Really, pierogies are really very, very nice, but I thought I'd also share with you the fact that among the Polish people, and they've got a very strong Slavic background, obviously, they had so many different traditions, and the holiday, like the summer solstice, it was really celebrated. and they had bonfires, and they would just do anything and everything, because often at these special celebrations during the summer, the young women and the young men, well, they were looking for that very special someone that could be in their life, and they had a tradition with flowers that was quite a lovely tradition. Anyway, that's a little bit of history about food. And I thought I would share a little bit more with you relative to the Polish people, because Poland is not unlike Afghanistan in that it's landlocked to a degree. And it has been said that the Polish people describe themselves as living between the bear and the wolf. And, of course, Russia is the bear, and the wolf is Germany. And one of the earliest acts by Germany when it unified itself was a ratification of its borders, assuming that Poland would not seek to gain or to regain German land that was lost to Poland after World War II. There's so much history that goes back thousands of years in Europe. And here in the United States, we are discovering that this country, contrary to belief systems, was quite populated by so many different peoples. And disease exterminated a great many of them when the Europeans started coming in, and there had been people that had been living in the Americas for thousands of years. Had cities, had their own kind. They're discovering so much in South America that until we developed the technology, they had no idea about the peoples, their intelligence, their tremendous sophistication in engineering. We just automatically think if some peoples are thousands of years old, they were very primitive. Well, guess what? We're learning that that is not necessarily the case. I just loved it when it was finally discovered that Neanderthals were not a bunch of nincompoops. So if anybody ever calls you a Neanderthal, take it as a compliment. They were quite a brilliant, brilliant people. One of the things, too, because we were talking about plants earlier that I thought I would bring up, the plant kingdom is the basis for most pharmaceutical products. And in Slovenia, St. John's wort was used to soothe people's skin. And what they would do, they would mix the St. John's wort with olive oil to treat sunburn, insect bites, and bruises. Now, there was a study. You know, so many times people say, oh, these old wives' tales. Who's going to listen to all this nonsense? Well, there was, in 2010, an Iranian randomized double-blind clinical study of 144 women published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine. Those women that had gone through cesarean sections and applied a St. John's wort ointment 3 times a day for 16 days after their surgeries had improved wound healing and less pain and scarring than those in the placebo and control groups. Animal studies out of Turkey in recent years determine that the plant, St. John's wort, heals wounds and burns. Rats that were treated topically with St. John's wort 4 times a day healed far more rapidly than those rats that were not healed with the St. John's worts. And this is something that as we become wiser, we learn that science is going to often bring forth the realities about many myths that were assumed to be just that. And they're going to find there's a basis for that. And that old world healing made a difference. Donna Sebo here. I'm so glad we've had a chance to visit and that you joined me. Remember, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. And wherever you are, won't you keep that light of yourself bright, shining? We have so many people that have no clue that good things in life are available 24/7. I'll be in studio with you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.